In Guatemala.
Tomasa Osorio Chen recounts a scene from the ferocious Rio Negro massacre that included an enormous amount of raping, which she survived. When the killing began, they tied the women up and hit them to kill them. One of the women asked, "Why are you killing me?" She kicked the PAC, the civil patroller. That PAC slit her in the stomach with a machete. When he slit her with the machete, the PAC wiped his hands on the machete and sucked on the blood. In Bosnia, in a Serbian rape camp. Kadira, a Bosnian victim from the Doboja rape camp, recalls, "I saw about 7 or 8 little girls who died after they were raped. I saw how they took them away to be raped and then brought them back unconscious. The Serbs threw them down in front of us and we weren't allowed to look at them. You had to keep looking at the floor the whole time. And then they'd announce, 'Look, that's what'll happen to you too if you resist and disobey Serbian law.'" Kadira explains that the Serbs wanted to kill us slowly, torture us to death. They wanted us to suffer. They wanted to show us in every way they could that they were stronger. A second victim, Ifita, concurs, "The Serbs didn't want sex. They were gloating because they were humiliating Muslim women." In Rwanda, Fulgence Bunani, a Hutu killer, recalls his comrades' laughter. "When we saw Tutsi wriggling like snakes in the marshes, it made the guys laugh. Some let them crawl a while longer for more fun. But that was not the case for everybody. Some didn't care one way or the other and didn't bother with that mockery. If it was easier to catch them crawling, that was better, and that was all." Patricia Musabye Maria, who had been incarcerated by Hutu in the Interahamwe, "They ordered me to take Deo, her 2-year-old son, to a pit latrine. When we got there, I saw that it was already full of corpses. I was to kill him myself, but I refused. I pleaded with those who would kill him to allow me to go away before they macheted him. After a few minutes, I saw them looking for hose to put the soil on my son's body. They were boasting that the father was the first in the pit, now let the son act as the lid." In Darfur, Masalit women recall the words of the Janjaweed perpetrators, "Slaves, Nubas, do you have a god? Break the Ramadan. Even we with pale skin don't observe the Ramadan. You, ugly black, pretend. We are your god. Your god is Omar al-Bashir, Sudan's political Islamic president. And you blacks, you have spoiled the country. We are here to burn you. We will kill your husbands and sons, and we will sleep with you. You will be our wives." The perpetrators' speech and emotional displays convey their attitudes toward the ignominies, cruelties, and lethal blows they inflict on their victims. The perpetrators express their hatred for the victims. The perpetrators impart their conceptions of the victims as beings that deserve their fates. The perpetrators exclaim words of joy about their deeds. They gloat. They boast. They take pride in their deeds. They mock the victims and celebrate their deaths. And the perpetrators laugh. Again and again we hear their laughter at the victims' suffering, at what they themselves are doing to them. As the reports from perpetrators themselves, bystanders, and surviving victims from one eliminationist assault to the next make clear, the perpetrators' speech and emotional displays at the time they were handling, brutalizing, and killing their victims constitute overwhelming evidence that they were assenting and willing executioners. Erwin Grafman, a member of a unit of 500 ordinary Germans, not SS men, that killed and deported to their deaths tens of thousands of Jews, reports that after their commander, Papa Trapp, told them they did not have to kill, "I did not witness that a single one of my comrades said that he did not want to participate. The rightness of killing Jews was so self-evident to them that, at the time, we did not give it any second thoughts at all." Why? One of Grafman's comrades explains that to Jews, whom they deemed equivalent to bandits, the category of human being was not applicable. In Southwest Africa, four decades earlier, German soldiers took the initiative to confine 25 half-starved Herero men, women and children, and little girls in a small enclosure of thorn bushes, surrounded and covered them with logs and branches, sprinkled the fuel with lamp oil, and burnt the Herero to a cinder. "I saw this personally," says Hendrik Fraser, a bastard. "The Germans said we should burn all these dogs and baboons in this fashion." "It became clear to us very quickly," reports a Kikuyu survivor about the Kikuyu's shared conclusions of the British generally, "that the British wanted to kill us, and those that were not killed were going to suffer. That was what those times were like. They just thought we were animals." Jesus Teku Osorio, who lost his parents and many family members during the Rio Negro massacre in Guatemala and is now one of the country's best-known human rights advocates, says about the obvious willingness of the perpetrators, "When they committed the acts, almost all acted with their own will. Perhaps they weren't obligated, but during the massacres they could do whatever they wanted. They could rape the women. So at the massacre of Rio Negro, perhaps it was not their first experience. They could have had other experiences, so that day they acted very willingly. That is how I saw it that day." Similarly, Cambodian survivors regularly describe the Khmer Rouge as wholly willing and impassioned mass murderers, declaiming the necessity of their deeds, including exterminating people for the sake of Angkar, a shorthand for the transformed and purified Cambodian society they sought to create. Rithi Yung endured 4 years under the Khmer Rouge in a mobile labor unit, so he encountered an enormous number of Khmer Rouge. He recounts the perpetrators telling the victims many things, indicating they believed what they were doing to the victims right, even explicitly that they enjoyed it. How does he know this? His speech quickens and becomes emphatic. "Oh yes, they say they enjoy it. They just said you are what we call the wealthy people. You know, you believe in imperialism." When asked how many perpetrators said such things, Young replies with animation and conviction, "All the Khmer. All the soldiers, all the people that watch us, they say that." In Bosnia, Alisa Murat-Kaos, herself a rape victim and rape camp survivor, speaks authoritatively not only from her own experience, but also on behalf of the 6,000 members of the Association of Concentration Camp Torture Survivors in Sarajevo, of which she is president. They collectively have first-hand, intimate experience with an enormous number of Serbian perpetrators. Murat-Kaos describes the perpetrators as wholly willing and eager executioners and vocal about their approval, expressing their hatred and their desire to utterly rid Bosnia of Bosnians. "Definitely, definitely," she says, referring to the perpetrators' willingness, hatred for the victims, and use of rape as a political weapon. "It was an expression of hatred, definitely, all of these, all of these." Anne, a Tutsi survivor captured hiding in the bush as Hutu used dogs to ferret out every last Tutsi, first had to watch as the Hutu killed all my children in front of me, and they slashed my right arm. Then, while they were raping me, they were saying that they wanted to kill all Tutsi so that in the future all that would be left would be drawings to show that there were once people called the Tutsi. And why did the Hutu want to obliterate the Tutsi? Eli Ingarambi, a Hutu killer, explains that the killers did not know that the Tutsi were human beings, because if they had thought about that, they wouldn't have killed them. "Let me also include myself as someone who accepted it. I wouldn't have accepted that the Tutsi are human beings." Ingarambi is emphatic about this being the common view and common knowledge. "As I was hearing it, I had the same perception as others at the time," adding, as this was such a fact of Hutu society, that no Hutu could swear and lie to you that he did not know that. "The effect of this," he explains, "it is a cloud that came into people's hearts and covered them, and everything became dark, because to see someone standing in front of you without any energy, and you hold your machete high or a club and hit him, it is something difficult that was done with a lot of anger and rage. I mean, this genocide. The facts of the perpetrator's bodily actions offer voluminous evidence that seamlessly complements the evidence of the perpetrator's words, showing that they approve of the eliminationist assaults and goals to which they contribute. As these and legions of instances demonstrate, eliminationist perpetrators routinely degrade and torture their victims physically. They degrade them by using them as playthings, bending them to their will, using them to display their dominance, showing them in so many, often diabolical ways that they are masters and the victims are without rights, respect, or the basic human protections. The perpetrators imprint on their victims' bodies, and thereby their psyches, their conception of them as worthless or vile beings who deserve their hopeless fate. Breaking the victims' bodies and spirit is often integral to the eliminationist project. For those victims for whom such cruelty is a prelude to death, they suffer the expressive venting of the perpetrator's hatred. For those victims left alive, the crippling, defining memories of suffering are also meant to warn them of their fate should they resist or seek to turn the tables. The perpetrator's organized raping, such as the Serbs' institutionalized raping of Bosniak and Kosovar women, is a textbook instance. Such perpetrators' actions and expressions are mass extermination and elimination's commonplaces, familiar to those even passably acquainted with such operations. They cannot possibly be accounted for by any postulate holding the perpetrators to disapprove or not approve of their deeds. If you are told to kill or guard a person, you do not have to degrade, mock, and torture that person. You do not have to pursue her death with zeal, passion, and energy, and take initiative to execute the deed. You do not have to memorialize the deed by taking trophy photographs of your quarry or handiwork, of the kind contained in the photo album of a Japanese soldier in Manchuria titled Bandit Suppression Operation Commemorative Picture, which captured soldiers going into action. The album contained several photos of scenes in which the soldier himself had participated. One showed three severed heads, one with eyes still staring, balanced on a fence. Another, a soldier holding a precisely severed head by its hair, the face turned toward the camera. Yet another of a Chinese, his arms bound tightly, is captured in the soldier's own hand. His life hangs by a thread. A fact ignored by all those denying the German perpetrators' willingness and approval is the reason archives filled with photographs of the Holocaust exist. The perpetrators took them. They did so obviously not to create evidence to indict themselves, but to memorialize and celebrate their deeds. In emblematic scenes from the Holocaust, German personnel at Auschwitz, where the Germans gassed more than 1 million Jews, let themselves be photographed in festive, merry poses preserved in a photograph of Karl Hocker, the adjutant of the camp commander. Similarly, Kurt Franz, the commander of Treblinka, where the Germans gassed more than 700,000 Jews, kept a photographic scrapbook celebrating his time there. As his handwritten words on one page tell us, as the good old days. The Germans regularly photographed the Jews in agony or dead, often in piles, or themselves in joyous poses mocking them, frequently forcing them to pose in genre scenes. The Germans were brazen and proud about their photographs. They passed them around, sent them home to loved ones, enshrined them in photo albums. German perpetrators treated the memorializing photographs of their extermination operations of Jews, including of Jew hunts, as their common property. One unit of ordinary German perpetrators hung their photographs in their headquarters so that the unit's members could order copies. Of these men who sent copies to their families, we do not know what they wrote. But we do know what Ferdinand Veltz, an artilleryman, wrote in May 1942 when he sent his parents several photographs. The batch included an extraordinarily gruesome, almost surrealistic bird's-eye view photograph of naked and partly clothed corpses of Polish Jews piled on top of one another in a ditch, with arms and legs and heads and torsos intertwined. Few people could look at such a shocking scene, of the sort many have probably never beheld, without recoiling in horror. Referring to these photographs, Veltz wrote, "I am enclosing for you several photographs, which I hope will not make you feel ill. Yes, they are Jews. For them, the dream of Germany's annihilation is over." He tells his parents that he no longer has the negatives. Could they please preserve the photos for him? Certainly, if you are told to kill a person, you do not have to celebrate and feast afterward. In Rwanda, such festivities began almost immediately with Major Bernard Intuyahaga, initially in charge of mass murdering Tutsi in Kigali's central residential area, celebrating the success afterward in noisy parties at his home. In the Nyamata commune, where ordinary Hutu hacked to death 50,000 of the 59,000 Tutsi living among them, the celebrations began after the first day of killing and continued on a nightly basis, as different Hutu killers report. "The evening atmosphere was festive," says one. Another concurs. "In the evening, families listened to music, the men sang, everyone drank, the women changed dresses 3 times in an evening. It was noisier than weddings. It was drunken reveling every day." The Germans also frequently marked their killings with symbolic displays. Particularly after large killing operations or when milestones had been reached in exterminating the Jews of a particular area, they held death banquets, victory celebrations, or as the Chełmno extermination camp's staff did upon the camp's closing after annihilating more than 145,000 Jews, a self-satisfied farewell party. Serbs similarly festively marked their deeds in Bosnia, with no less than communal celebrations blessed by their church leaders, who conducted formal rituals celebrating town cleansings of all non-Serbs. If you disapproved of mass killings, you would not do these things. If you believed that you had to kill someone, or the person telling you to do so would kill you, or were somehow pressured or somehow felt duty-bound to kill someone you held to be an innocent victim, you would not choose to torture the person first, or increase his suffering, let alone do so with evident glee. You would do the opposite. Yet the evidence suggests that few actual perpetrators ever did. Had the perpetrators disapproved of mass murder and elimination, they would have created a substantial record, a vast record of such disapproval, in contemporaneous utterances, letters to family and friends, and diaries, in their actions in so many ways, by foot-dragging, sabotage, doing the job badly, and by acting and speaking kindly to the victims, which survivors would have surely eagerly reported in gratitude. All that has come to light from all our ages' mass murders and eliminations amounts to virtually nothing, to no credible record of such disapproval and dissent. This absence is all the more striking because people living under the most coercive regimes, including people living under the very regimes that practiced eliminationist politics, have left vast records of disapproval, dissent, and resistance against the regimes and against their measures that the people particularly disliked. The postulates that the perpetrators disapprove or do not approve of their deeds are falsified by the facts of just the eliminationist politics' signature act for which they were put forward, the killing itself. When such claims are held up to the perpetrators' other actions, which the claims studiously and not surprisingly ignore, they do not even make sense. These widespread acts of cruelty and celebration, the perpetrators' approving words when dealing with, brutalizing, and killing their victims, reveal themselves to be integral to the eliminationist project's execution. They flatly contradict the notion that those implementing them see the projects as wrong. Had the perpetrators the world over never killed a single person, but still done all the other things they actually did do to their victims, then I think two things would have happened. The perpetrators' many and various non-lethal acts toward their victims would not have been lost, let alone been almost entirely obscured in the shadow cast by the killing and its overwhelming horror, and lost, as they are in study after study, from our analytical view. And, in light of the then overwhelming and apparent evidence that makes the idea that perpetrators disapproved of all their own cruelties, brutalities, and degradations of the victims, and disapproved of their expressions of hatred and mockery, of approval and merriment, utterly absurd, no one would have put forward postulates depending on the notion that the perpetrators saw their own eliminationist acts as wrong. These postulates have been most systematically and thoroughly assessed for the mass murder for which many were first advanced, and have been most frequently and forcefully asserted, the Germans' annihilation of the Jews. In Hitler's Willing Executioners, I demonstrated that they are conceptually untenable and belied by overwhelming evidence, including the voluminous testimony of the survivors, each one having often observed over the years many, frequently hundreds of German perpetrators, and the testimony of those killers who speak candidly. As one ordinary German perpetrator explains in giving testimony about all those he knew during the annihilation, "I must admit that we felt a certain joy when we would seize a Jew whom one could kill. I cannot remember an instance when a policeman had to be ordered to an execution. The shootings were, to my knowledge, always carried out on a voluntary basis. One could have gained the impression that various policemen got a big kick out of it." Oscar Pincus, a Jewish survivor, drawing on his own experience and other Jewish victims' observations, does not blame the Germans for implementing their orders because "we never expected individual Germans to disobey orders." Instead, the Germans' record is fatal because, above and beyond the orders, they individually and voluntarily, actively and tacitly, endorsed, enjoyed, and enlarged the official program of extermination. Pincus could have been speaking for the survivors of one mass murder and elimination after the next. In their vast testimony, survivors of eliminationist assaults, when they address the issues, say almost in a single voice that the perpetrators hated and wanted to kill them. They give no reason to think the perpetrators were disapproving, reluctant, or unwilling, and every reason to believe that perpetrators endorsed, enjoyed, and enlarged the eliminationist program. There is simply no plausible account that does not make up or ignore the basic facts that can tell us why, absent massive coercion, so many people against their will would slaughter other people. And there is no plausible account of any kind for why disapproving people, indeed so many disapproving people across cultures and time, would torture the victims and celebrate in their deaths and expulsions. If we wish to understand and explain why the killers kill, why the eliminationist warriors physically and symbolically assault their victims, we must first recognize the sobering truth that perpetrators, exceptions notwithstanding, approve of what they are doing. Fulgence, an ordinary Hutu who willingly slaughtered Tutsi, epigrammatically and emblematically conveys what has been true of perpetrators. "I thought wrong. I went wrong. I did wrong." Recognizing this then leads to the question and the investigation of how the perpetrators came to this approval, came to the point where they thought wrong, and why they see the annihilation, expulsion, and incarceration of other peoples and groups as right, necessary, and laudable. But before doing so, another aspect of mass slaughters must be fully confronted and analyzed: the gruesomeness. Treatments of the Holocaust, because of their omission of the perpetrators and their analytically misleading emphasis on the faceless gas chambers, which established a sanitized paradigm of inquiry and understanding for mass murders in general, have effectively obscured the horror of the act of killing, not for the victims, which we all know, but for the perpetrators. In the overwhelming majority of our time's mass murders, the perpetrators killed their victims face to face, typically individual killer to individual victim. In so many, the killers slaughtered people with handheld implements. For so many perpetrators, it is literally true, and for so many more, it would be metaphorically correct to say that they, Germans, British in Kenya, Indonesians, Khmer Rouge, Guatemalans, Tutsi in Burundi, Hutu in Rwanda, Serbs, Sudanese, and many more, butchered their victims. Eli Ingarambi, a Hutu killer, now mild-mannered, is by his own account utterly transformed because he and other demythologized killers no longer believe, as they once did, that Tutsi are not human beings but snakes and cockroaches seeking to enslave the Hutu. He looks back on the events with understanding, but also with a degree of incredulity at how he and all the others could cut up people. I cannot find a way to explain that, but the only answer I can get is that it was like a cloud, something like darkness. I can call it ignorance. Then he corrects himself, for even though the poisonous things they held Tutsi to be were a kind of ignorance, but it is not ignorance. It is cruelty that we worked with my fellow criminals in Rwanda. What they did, their cruelty, Ingarambi demonstrated for me with chopping hand motions of great precision, showing me how Hutu cut their victims into pieces. You see, you would hold a machete like this. Then you would run after a person and hack him like this, slash him, and after that you would ground him and cut him into pieces. But the most common weapon was a club. You would hit and ground the head. With a machete, it was like how you cut a banana tree. The only difference is that flesh is soft, but the tree is hard. A person you cut once, and the second time, he is in pieces. Blood everywhere. Screams of agony. Victims pleading for their lives, or alternately, to be killed more quickly to end their pain. How would the perpetrators, uncoerced, summon the psychological and emotional wherewithal to do this if they did not believe their actions were right, good, and necessary? How would they do it time after time? Think of the difficulty you may have, and that so many people do have, in hearing this book's descriptions of perpetrators torturing or killing innocent men, women, and children. Think of people, perhaps including you, wincing when hearing such accounts or seeing such scenes in documentaries. Think of how much harder, 10, 100, 1,000, an infinite number of times harder, it would be for you to be killing, slaughtering, butchering a man with a machete. Or a woman. Or a child. You cut him. Then cut him again. They cut him again and again. Think of listening to the person you are about to murder begging, crying for mercy, for her life. Think of hearing your victim's screams as you hack at or cut her, and then cut her again and again and again, or the screams of a boy as you hack at his 8-year-old body. Yet the perpetrators do it, and hear it, and they do it with zeal, alacrity, and self-satisfaction, even enjoyment. They do it again and again and again. Ingarambi explains that the people pleaded, saying, "Please forgive me, I am going to give you money." Or a woman would say, "Please forgive me." Or, "Take me and take care of me, see, I am a beautiful woman." And you say, "No, I am going to kill you instead." Then the perpetrator would cut or club his victim, and cut or club her or him again in the manner Ingarambi demonstrated and described in blow-by-blow detail. Not surprisingly, some zealous executioners, including some Hutu, found it sometimes difficult to kill people they knew. This was met with a mixture of understanding and mild rebuke or a fine for the perpetrator, but no mercy for the victim. Ellie explains that someone who avoided the fatal gesture before a good acquaintance did it out of kindness to himself, not to his acquaintance, because he knew it brought no mercy to the other person, who'd be struck down anyhow. Quite the contrary, the victim might wind up cut more cruelly for having slowed up the job for a moment. Not surprisingly, some others find the actual butchery's blood and guts distasteful, just as not all meat-eaters want to work the slaughterhouse, and some killers need to acclimate themselves to the gore. One testifying German mass murderer makes it clear that he approved of the Jews' extermination, yet his first time killing, he felt discomfort. After he had already shot between about 10 to 20 Jews, I requested to be relieved, particularly because my neighbor shot so ineptly. Apparently, he always held the barrel of his rifle too high because horrible wounds were inflicted on the victims. In some cases, the entire rear skull of a victim was so shattered that brain matter spattered about. I simply could not look at it any longer. Not moral opposition, but disgust led him to ask for relief, a request his understanding superiors almost naturally granted. Just as it is wrong to gullibly accept the perpetrator's routine denials of their involvement, agency, and culpability, it is wrong, as some eagerly do, to point to a perpetrator shying away from killing an acquaintance or having such a visceral reaction, especially the first time he kills, as proof that he thinks his victims innocent and do not deserve to die. Testimony from the Indonesian slaughter of communists by a man referring to himself, conforming to Indonesian politeness rules, in the third person as Kartawijaja's son number two, speaks to this and other important themes. Usually those communists whom people had managed to round up were turned over to an executioner so that he could dispatch their souls to another world. Not everyone is capable of killing, though there are some exceptions. According to what a number of executioners themselves claimed, for Kartawijaja's son number two had many friends among them, killing isn't easy. After dispatching the first victim, one's body usually feels feverish and one can't sleep. But once one has sent off a lot of souls to another world, one gets used to killing. It's just like butchering a goat, they'd claim. And the fact is that Kartawijaja's son number two often stole out of the house, either to help guard the local PNI, Indonesian National Party headquarters, located in the home of Pak Salim, the driver of the school bus in the area around Inga Derejo, or to watch the dispatch of human souls. This too made sleeping difficult, remembering the moans of the victims as they begged for mercy, the sound of the blood bursting from the victims' bodies, or the spouting of fresh blood when a victim was beheaded. All of this pretty much made one's hair stand on end, to say nothing of the screams of a Garwani leader as her vagina was pierced with a sharpened bamboo pole. Many of the corpses lay sprawled like chickens after decapitation. How could the perpetrators bear doing this? More, since they obviously approved of their deeds, as their symbolic degradation of the Garwani leader indisputably shows, why did they relish it? Kartawijaja's son number two, because he draws on his friend's contemporaneous confidences to him, knows. He explains in his very next sentence that the executioner's finding the blood and gore unsettling had nothing to do with principled disapproval of the deed. Far from it. But even though such events were pretty horrifying, the participants felt thankful to have been given the chance to join in destroying infidels. The perpetrators' beliefs and how they come to hold them. The questions, do the killers believe the victims deserve what they are getting, and do the killers think their deeds are right and necessary, are not the most significant ones. The answer is all but invariably yes. The crucial question is why and how eliminationist perpetrators come to view their victims and their slaughtering of their victims in this way. This question has more complex and variable answers. Only by tackling it directly can we gain certain necessary insights into mass murder and elimination's genesis and course. This requires exploring the perpetrator's motives and the political, social, cultural, and situational contexts in which their motives come into being. How perpetrators conceive of the targeted people is the critical factor in their willingness to participate in mass murder and elimination in the first place, in their willingness to visit non-lethal atrocities upon the victims, and in the character and scope of their assault. Kartawijaja's son number two's acquaintances, and the Indonesian mass murderers generally, saw the communists as enormously threatening infidels whose souls had to be dispatched to another world. So when a throng of perpetrators from Nahdlatul Ulama, NU, the main Muslim political party, converged upon a Communist Party office, Kardawijaja's son number two reports that, as usual before carrying out their task, the NU masses roared, "Allahu Akbar! Allah is great!" They then brutally beat a man they found in front of the office and burned the building down. This is a textbook illustration of the intimate relationship between belief, motive, and action. Structures, such as living under a particular regime or being a guard in a camp, could not possibly explain the perpetrator's actions, because structural explanations deny that such a relationship exists, let alone that it has the central place it really occupies. Structural explanations hold that what is in a person's head is essentially unimportant for generating his actions. Instead, the political or social structures of institutions or circumstances themselves produce people's conduct and do so invariably. Aside from the multiple conceptual and empirical reasons to reject the conventional explanations that have been shown here to be hopelessly faulty, coercion, authority, social psychological pressure, and bureaucratic membership are different kinds of structures. So they, like structural forces in general, also cannot explain the variations in what they must explain. And they cannot because a constant force or influence cannot be the cause of inconsistent or variable actions or outcomes. So the structure itself, which is invariable, cannot explain eliminationist assault's many variations, some of which were strikingly in evidence in Germany and Rwanda. The Germans had differential success in finding willing helpers and general social support in the different countries they occupied. And within each country, there was variation in people's support for the Germans' eliminationist assault on the Jews in the first place. These variations did not derive from variations in the German occupation's severity, but had everything to do with local anti-Semitism's extent and character. Danes, by and large, did not help the Germans. Lithuanians, Poles, Slovaks, and Ukrainians much more frequently did. Indeed, in Lithuania, Ukraine, and elsewhere, upon the Germans' defeat of the Soviets, local peoples, having received the green light from the Germans, voluntarily and with enormous brutality slaughtered the Jews among them. Italians helped the Germans only infrequently. French did so more, but with enormous variability. The Germans could not turn just anyone into a willing mass murderer. Many helped willingly, and many other people in different countries resisted. And just as they knew their own people, the German leaders knew that the anti-Semitic peoples of many other countries would help them, while some would not, correctly anticipating at the Wannsee Conference genocidal planning meeting that they would have difficulty getting Danes and others in Scandinavia to go along with the deportation and mass murder of the Jews. Under State Secretary Martin Luther comments that if this problem is dealt with thoroughly, then difficulties will arise in some countries, for example in the Nordic countries, and it would therefore be advisable to exclude these countries for the time being. Even the clergy of different Christian churches in different countries took strikingly different stances toward the Jews' persecution and mass murder. The stances generally accorded with their own particular church's religious and cultural attitudes toward Jews, which were embedded in their country's particular national cultures. Among Protestant churches, the German Protestant churches supported the eliminationist assault the most. The Catholic Church overall and individual national Catholic churches were openly behind the general eliminationist program, much more than their co-national Protestant churches were, and sometimes vigorously supported its different aspects, in some countries even publicly encouraging or supporting the extermination itself. Rwanda provides the rare eliminationist instance of a government's unleashing and empowering one entire people, the Hutu, to slaughter a second entire people, the Tutsi, who everywhere were the first group's co-workers, classmates, and neighbors. Any Hutu could join the slaughtering right in his own town, village, or neighborhood. Many Hutu were encouraged to. Some were compelled. While Tutsi survivors' extensive testimony, corroborated by Hutu perpetrators, recounts a staggering number of ordinary Hutu with evident willingness and zeal killing Tutsi, there is also credible testimony that in certain villages and communes, some Hutu resisted killing their Tutsi neighbors. Some, but not all of them, faced the unbearable choice of kill or be killed. But the overwhelming majority of the Hutu who killed did not. They fell upon the Tutsi, strangers or neighbors, with approval and many even with alacrity. Hutu Christian clergy aided and joined in. Many other variations in the perpetrators' actions cannot be explained by the political or institutional structures. In camps, all victims are powerless and all perpetrators are unconstrained and all-powerful. Yet the perpetrators systematically treat different victim categories differently. In some eliminationist onslaughts, as in the Holocaust and Rwanda, the fates of victim men, women, and children were largely undifferentiated. In others, as in the Turkish, Indonesian, and Serbian onslaughts, the perpetrators treated them markedly dissimilarly. In light of these and other variations discussed in depth momentarily, three sets of themes need to be investigated. 1. How, when, and over what period are the perpetrators' beliefs generated? 2. Are all mass murderous or eliminationist beliefs roughly equivalent? And if not, then how do they vary and how do these variations matter? 3. How do other factors, such as fellow killers' enthusiasm, intersect with and perhaps reinforce the perpetrators' beliefs about the target groups to influence the perpetrators to act as they do? Much writing about mass murder erroneously assumes it is a unitary phenomenon and that an explanation of how the desire to slaughter people is generated in one instance must be true in all instances. Mass murders have certain common features, but they also have others, including motives and the processes that produce the motives, that vary. Not surprisingly, how people come to think that other people ought to die occurs in different ways. Our analysis begins with a well-grounded view already present in this discussion. People of most countries and cultures live with an ethic that holds human beings to have a basic human value, which means that killing a person is a morally significant act of some kind, or as a shorthand, a moral act, usually deemed immoral, in the way that cutting the grass or inadvertently stepping on an ant is not. The view that killing a person is a moral act leads to the question, how do people develop the contrary belief that certain specific groups do not possess that human value, so that killing them is not immoral? How is the moral position developed that the members of those groups must die? There are four basic ways this willingness to kill comes about. The first has a different starting point from the others. There have been societies and cultures, probably the majority of them prior to the Enlightenment and then the dissemination of its ideas, that have not recognized human beings' universality and moral equality. Instead, human value was seen to be possessed only by a minority, often only a given society's or culture's members. The ancient Greeks, those romanticized civilizers, while sometimes democrats among themselves, really only among certain classes of men, held slaves who, according to no one less than Aristotle, lacked reason. Greeks believed non-Greeks, deemed barbarians, lacked full human qualities. In such cases throughout history, a dominant group's instrumental treatment of people, to be used or eliminated according to the dominant group's needs and capabilities, has been the norm. The dehumanized status and treatment of many peoples historically is particularly well known for one common condition: slavery. Most human societies historically have enslaved others, who were also subject to being killed, except when a slave-holding society's laws forbade it to protect the polity's interests and norms. European colonizers treated people of color the world over as being of a different kind, often as barely human, to be dispensed with, including as slaves or production factors or corpses, according to convenience and practicality. We must consider that also during our time, certain societies and cultures have not accorded basic human value to all or most human beings long prior to its members committing mass murder, and that killing people has therefore not depended upon stripping this value from them. It may be that in some societies and cultures, or subcultures, there has been a generalized disregard for human life, save perhaps people's own reference group. So killing people has not been the existentially monumental and morally significant act that, during our age, it otherwise has been. Because societies and cultures can nurture people with such an ethnocentric ethic, we must acknowledge the possibility that in our era, certain perpetrators have easily come to see slaughtering their victims as desirable because it has been seen as necessary, and they could come to view mass killing, what we would call mass murder, this way, because they never saw their victims as having fundamental human value, and therefore certain basic rights, in the first place. Nothing moral had to be removed, no great transformation had to occur for them to be incapable of feeling genuine sympathy with the target groups. Such killers' language of justification is amoral utilitarianism. In the first centuries of their colonialism, Europeans treated the technologically inferior African, Asian, and Native American peoples they conquered generally with amoral utilitarianism, to be employed or disposed of according to the Europeans' needs. Also, the natives, by their resistance to the so-called civilizing process, or merely to the self-styled superior Europeans' goals, gave proof of their putative inherent inferiority and unfitness. How long this attitude continued to prevail varied from country to country and people to people, though it certainly moved the European perpetrators in their eliminationist assaults on African peoples during our time. In Asia, the Chinese's colossal mass murders before and after the communist takeover, which occurred under several political contexts and regimes, raised the question of whether this amoral utilitarianism has at least partly existed there, at least until midway through the 20th century. The extremely culturally ethnocentric imperial Japan preyed on Asian peoples in this manner, hearkening back to European colonialists, though drawing on indigenous Japanese cultural sources for these attitudes and practices. It may also be that such attitudes existed amidst the Congo's violent anarchy during the past several years. Yet in the story of our time, these instances, as important as they are the exceptions. Our age's mass murders and eliminations have overwhelmingly been perpetrated by people nurtured in societies and cultures that assigned fundamental human value to people in general. In such societies, this protective attribute had to be stripped away for the perpetrators to see other people as deserving death or elimination. This has occurred in three basic ways. 1. People who had no particular prejudice or animus for another group can have hatred forged in the heat of real, usually military, conflicts that lead them to believe that the enemy people must be defeated at any cost, permanently, and deserve the worst. 2. People can become beholden to political ideologies that call for destroying or eliminating others. If such ideological regimes are in power long enough to socialize new generations, they can educate a reservoir of like-minded followers who will willingly act upon the regimes and their own eliminationist beliefs. 3. People can have pre-existing powerful prejudices against specific groups, which then get activated for lethal and other eliminationist aims by leaders bent on eliminationist politics. More than one of these pathways can be operating, sometimes on different perpetrators, sometimes regarding different victim groups. Nevertheless, whatever the complexity, one of them is usually dominant, and its lineaments are easily discernible.